So I do want to bring on, without further ado, because I know he's holding and on a schedule, Jacob Bender, who, as I said, is the executive director of our local chapter of CARE. And Jacob, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be on.
Yeah. Now, I know you were one of millions of Americans, as were we all, who saw the presidential address last night. And so I guess my first question, our first question to you is the theme that seemed to be raised, and, you know, we're media folks, so the soundbite that was my takeaway from it is that freedom is stronger than fear. Is it?
It's a difficult question to answer at a time like this in the wake of the recent tragedies, but I think we need to keep hope alive, to use a phrase of a former presidential candidate, and not give in to the worst instincts that human beings are capable of. And I think at the end of the day, we will prove that freedom and liberty and equality is a stronger antidote to fear and violence and terrorism than the sole use of military action.
What was your reaction, and maybe I should ask, what is CARE's reaction to the presidential speech last night?
I think that the president hit a number of notes which were well received within the American Muslim community, that the perpetrators of violence are a small percentage, an infinitesimally small percentage of the worldwide Muslim population, numbering 1.6 billion people. And if we allow the violence in San Bernardino to create a situation which would be reminiscent of what Japanese Americans experienced during World War II, and some of our presidential candidates are getting very close to, I think, advocating that, then we would indeed hand ISIL a victory.
Mr. Bender, what would you say? Actually, I don't know if you saw the article in the Philadelphia Inquirer today. It was in the local news. It was entitled "Muslim Stung by Bias," and it just was. It was talking about the these Arab Americans who have experienced a lot of bias as they travel from city to city, because when they speak in Arabic, people are suspicious. They're afraid to get on the planes. They're being asked to come off planes and being searched and all kinds of other, you know, crazy things, because people are just operating out of fear. What do you say to American Muslims? You know, I think there are, what, 3 million or so of American Muslims. What do you say to them right now? How do you, I mean, is a bad thing to be an American and have to be profiled on a daily basis? African Americans know what that feels like, by the way, because we do that. We go through that on a daily basis also. But what would you say to American Muslims who are listening to you? Because it's not a good thing right now.
It's definitely not a good thing, and it violates the best instincts of our country, and why we, in spite of actions of our government that we may disagree with, we nonetheless feel a great pride in this country and the values which it bestows upon its citizens. However, those values have needed to be defended and fought for by immigrant groups in the past. And so if we look at American history, only 100 years ago, the exact same insults which are now being thrown at the Muslim community were directed at white Catholics,
right,
who were accused,
right,
of being un-American,
right,
who were accused of being intrinsically anti-woman, who Catholicism was accused, as Islam was, of being incompatible with democracy. We can remember the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Right.
And so the struggles that Muslim Americans are going through now is nothing new in our country. But what we can see is that American democracy holds forth the promise, not the guarantee, but the promise of liberty and equality. And sometimes those values and those rights many times have to be struggled for by each new wave of immigrants coming into this country. So I would urge people in the Muslim community not to give up hope, not to give up faith in the American system, but try as best to reform it and bend it to the will of justice.
You know, one of the other things that the president said, I think, is probably more controversial in the Muslim community, and is going to raise controversy generally. But I guess I want to draw an analogy first and then ask my question. In the African-American community now, we are struggling mightily, especially in communities that are racked by violence, with this idea and the entreaty of law enforcement and other officials and authorities to say to especially our younger people, look, if you see an act of violence and you know of an act of violence, you should help us get the perpetrators. That and then there's this, you know, the backlash about no snitching and all that kind of stuff, and it becomes a cultural struggle in many ways, because many of us have grown up in communities where we didn't particularly trust law enforcement to be on our side. Even if you called them, you know, you might solve your problem, but it created other ones. And so in some ways, African Americans look at a relationship with law enforcement and with the authority figures in much the same way as many immigrants do. And so what the president asked last night was that, one, that certainly we should not and cannot turn on each other, but that also that leaders and average citizens in Muslim communities across this country have a responsibility to work with everyone, work together with us to help to stop terrorism on a local basis. And what I assumed that implied, and I could be wrong, but what I assumed that implied was that people have a responsibility also to say, you know what, my guy down the street is not acting right, or he looks like he's building a bunker, or I don't know what, or he's going to the gun range a lot, or I don't know what, but the people who are closest to folk who look and believe like them are people who look and believe like you. And so how is this being received? How is it being interpreted in terms of the responsibility that folk in the Muslim community have to help ferret out terrorism in our midst?
Well, this is exactly what the Muslim community has been doing, is struggling against those rare voices of extremism and violence that they may find within their communities. However, as you say, the question of working with local law enforcement people is fraught with historical and contemporary difficulty. Mm. We know only too well that there have, in fact, been informants placed within mosques and within Muslim organizations to, in fact, try to foment and create plots of violence and preying on the suspicions and vulnerability of perhaps less than stable members of the American Muslim community. This has been amply reported by Washington journalist Trevor Aronson, who works for Al Jazeera and produced a film and a book called Informants. This should ring a bell of familiarity to those who remember
COINTELPRO. Oh, absolutely.
within the African American history.
Right.
On the other hand, the Muslim community and Muslim Americans generally have to be given the opportunity to find the space, on the one hand, to condemn unequivocally, which the community has done over and over again, acts of terrorism such as we saw in Paris or in San Bernardino, and on the other hand, to offer informed and sensitive criticism of American policy. And by doing so, should not raise the ire or suspicion of law enforcement, because questioning American foreign policy and the results that it has had around the world should not be seen as an act of disloyalty. On the other hand, it should be seen perhaps as the act of greatest patriotism. We could remember years ago that Dr. King faced great opposition within the civil rights movement when he wanted to come out and criticize the war in Vietnam.
In Vietnam. And right. You know what, as you were speaking, that was right. Exactly,
yeah, exactly
what I was thinking. Right. Mr. Bender, just hold on one second. We've got to take a quick break, but hold that thought. We'll be back in a minute. And this is 900 AM WURD. You're on the Talking Drumline with Barbara Grant and my co-pilot today, Trent Pettis. We're going to get around to talking about presidential politics in just a few minutes, but we've been having a conversation with Jacob Bender, who is executive director of the Philadelphia chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. And just before we went into the break, Jacob, I think you heard snippets of the president's speech last night talking about how some of these folk who have become, quote, radicalized, unquote, have really been relatively weak-minded people whose minds have been kind of played upon and tricked and things like that. And honestly, as I started to try to analyze this in my own tiny little mind, I started thinking that ISIL, if you will, has become kind of like a magnet for, you know, folk who would formerly like be like the Columbine kids,
right,
and
stoked,
like, yeah, right. Folk who were loners and right. disturbed and wanted some way right. to get back at people for whatever their right. reasons are now kind of, you know, have found a home, if right. you will.
Yes. Psychopaths of the world unite.
Yes. Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. But before the break, I think you were talking about walking this fine line about maintaining your rights to freedom of speech. And honestly, I wish we had as big a lobby for the free speech amendment as we do for the gun lobby.
Right.
But walking that line between being able to criticize the government in a healthy way and then working against terrorism simultaneously.
I think that's exactly the tact which has been done by the mainstream Muslim community in this country, manifested by my organization, CARE, which has maintained a consistent position against violence wherever it happens, including committed by Muslims or by people in the Arab world. But on the other hand, retaining the community's right to criticize policy when we feel it is not in the best interest of the United States itself, nor for people in that part of the region. Most Americans have yet to realize that the Middle East and Arabs are only 20% of the worldwide Muslim population, and the majority of Muslims live in Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Bangladesh, where instances such as we see in the Middle East are virtually non-existent. And therefore, without justifying in any way the horrendous violence committed in San Bernardino, we can look at perhaps the historical context that this violence is being committed. And so when the president said that this violence grew out, that ISIL grew out of the chaos of Iraq, we have to ask, what was the genesis of that chaos? Did it have anything to do with the insertion and the invasion of Iraq by United States of America? We were assured, of course, that it would be a cakewalk and that the soldiers would be thrown candy when they marched into Baghdad. And I think it's for a good reason that Bush Sr., in his latest book, makes an argument against the neocon advisors for Bush the Younger. And for good reason, talked about the ill-advised policy of trying to occupy a foreign country and change it by force of arms.
Which is criticism that many folk here, right. including folk here at this right. station and behind this mic, have had right. of the American foreign policy for some
time.
Trent, I think you had a question.
Well,
yes.
Speaking of presidential politics, what do you think when you hear candidates like Donald Trump and Ben Carson, you know, talking about having American Muslims registered in database, or just the really there's just all this Islamophobia that's coming out of those camps. Do you think there's any kind of correlation between this hate speech that's coming from these candidates and what is going on in places like San Bernardino or even maybe in Paris?
I'd be slow to establish a direct correlation there, but what we can say is that the open attacks upon the American Muslim community by leading presidential candidates is the most open and egregious attack on an American religious minority in living memory. And these people should be ashamed of themselves and sent to, you know, education camps to learn the, you know, true history of what they are talking about. Let me also say that on a personal level, as you may know, I myself am not an American Muslim, but in fact an American Jew.
Right.
When I hear people talking about registration of a minority, I'm thinking, you know, are they proposing that Muslims should go out and sew on stars and crescent on their sleeve?
Right, it's reminiscent of Nazi Germany.
Exactly.
Yeah, or be forbidden to, you know, marry non-Muslims. You know, these are suggestions which it's a slippery slope once you begin to pick on one community. And that the responsibility of combating Islamophobia should not rest upon solely the backs of the Muslim community, but it's the responsibility of all Americans to oppose that, in the same way that I was blessed to grow up in a household which saw that the struggle of African Americans was, in fact, our struggle as well. And for those of your listeners who have long historical memories, my mother told me wonderful stories about walking through the streets in Brighton Beach with a little contribution can. It's called a pushka in Yiddish, and would go up and down the streets yelling, "Save the Scottsboro boys, save the Scottsboro boys."
You know, today is sort of our political day, and we'll you know, let you go in a few minutes and talk more about the Trump phenomenon, if you will, because it's just stunning to me. But
should never underestimate the intelligence or overestimate the intelligence of the electorate.
There you go.
Democracy has its pluses and minuses.
Pluses and minuses, absolutely. I wondered, though, if a lot of people are just totally baffled by American foreign policy in the Mideast because it is incredibly complicated there, and nobody really is sure, you know, when you're on the right side or not. At least from watching television, and yet that there is this other dimension that we I think ignore, which is that people are also, I think most Americans are very confused about Islam, the religion itself, and what it teaches and what it doesn't teach. I mean, I have seen, you know, imams stand up at times like this and say, this is not what Islam teaches, although folk who are attracted to this philosophy seem to be wrapping themselves in the cloak of Islam. And so, as a person who's a believer, and I'm a Christian, I tend to think that maybe there is an effective or a useful route to helping to stop some of this by helping to explain more and helping us understand more about what true Islam teaches. It's a religion of peace.
Well, this is exactly what CARE has been doing since its founding 20 years ago and 10 years ago in Philadelphia. I would urge your listeners to look at our website, pa.care.com, to call our office, schedule lectures. We provide free workshops on the history and tradition of Islam and what Muslims believe. And, you know, the people around former President Bush talked often about a clash of civilizations. But I think it's more likely that we are witnessing a clash within civilizations, and that all of our religious traditions have extremists attached to it, whether they be Christian or Jewish or Muslim, but they also have people who stand for justice and equality. Let us remember that both the Ku Klux Klan and Dr. King took upon themselves the mantle of Christianity. And within my community, we have people who openly support whatever foreign policy Israel is engaged in, and we have numerous rabbis and dissidents, such as myself and the Jewish community, who have long argued that the Palestinian people deserve a home and a right to statehood, and that the settlements, which have been underwritten by the American government, are a detriment to peace between Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians in the Middle East. Again, it's part of the sort of critical prophetic tradition that I think I've been meeting more and more and been honored to work and discover within the Arab American community as an outsider. And I've been welcomed with open arms by that community and have learned wonderful, wonderful teachings of Islam from my teachers within the American Muslim community.
Jacob, we're going to take a break and let you go in a moment, but what would you say are our next steps for CARE in this context?
Well, to continue what we're doing, we need to strike out a position which unequivocally condemns violence without any secondary thoughts to it. And I think CARE jumped out and did that, as we have, as the organization and as my fellow directors in the 30 chapters around the country have done over and over again. But at the same time, to point out to our fellow Americans why certain aspects of American foreign policy may not be the most effective in combating the spread of dangerous and radical and violent-prone ideology. Let me also say that for non-Muslim Americans, struggling with the sense of vulnerability and violence, I would talk about an amazing organization that my wife works for called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. This was a group of 300 family members who found each other online, all of whom lost loved ones on the in the towers or in Washington, D.C., or in the fields of Pennsylvania. And yet these people have reached out to Arab Americans and to Muslim Americans and have tried to argue that reconciliation and understanding is the key to our future. The name Peaceful Tomorrows comes from a quote of Dr. King, which says that a war is a poor chisel to carve out peaceful tomorrows. And I would hope that my fellow Americans would understand the complexity of the situation as they go about mourning, as we do and as I do, the people who had their lives taken away from them in San Bernardino and in Paris and in many other places around the world.
Well, Jacob Bender, Executive Director of Philadelphia CARE, we are all hoping for peaceful tomorrows. Thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.